This is a reading of the cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity. This is Lecture 8. In analyzing, on the one hand, as we have been doing, the relation of sleeping and waking in man, and, on the other, the principles of his being, we see that man experiences in sleep a profound cleavage of his earthly existence. From the explanations I have given during the last few days, it will be clear that we have to distinguish what is perceptible to man's physical senses, his physical body, from that which is not now physically perceptible and can only be seen in an imagination, namely his etheric body, or as I must also call it, body of formative forces. This latter contains the living forces enabling man to grow. And underlying the processes of nourishment and of the whole building up of his body, and so on. This body of formative forces also contains, as we have seen, the entire system of human thought. Inserted into this formative force or etheric body, as also into the physical body, are the two higher principles of man's being, which may be called the astral body, though we may take exception to this terminology, and what we designate as the actual ego organization. Now, when a man lives his day life, these four principles of his nature are active one within the other. There is intercommunication and interharmony between them. When he passes into the state of sleep, his physical body and body of formative forces remain behind in bed, if I may so express it, while the astral body, or rather the astral organization and the ego organization, enter a purely spiritual world. Thus, from the time man falls asleep until he awakens, his being is split in two. On the one side, there is the physical organism with the etheric principle, which also retains his whole thought world, and on the other, the ego organization and that of the astral body. I believe someone here made the remark that if the whole thought world remains behind in the etheric organization during sleep, we cannot then, by means of the thoughts which we can only grasp in our waking state, exercise activity in the sleep state. The person who expressed this view is rather anxious, lest if he put into thought some wish for the good of his fellow men or the like, when he entered the sleeping state, or if the thought referred to a sleeping person, the force of such a thought would be lost, seeing that we cannot take it with us into the sleeping state. I should like to answer this by means of a picture. You have certainly never seen a man who wishes to hit a target throw his rifle at it. He fires a bullet at the target, but retains his rifle in his hand. One could not venture to suggest that the target will not be hit because he retained the rifle. In the same way, the effects of our thinking, waking life are not kept back from entering the sleep life because the thoughts themselves remain behind in the physical and etheric bodies and are not sent forth into the sleep life. With respect to such subtle things as these, we must always think much more accurately than we are ever required to do in the physical world, where things automatically correct themselves. From what has been said here in the last few days, it will be seen that there is a much more intimate relation between the physical and etheric bodies than between the etheric body and astral organization. For the physical and etheric bodies remain together throughout the whole of our earth life. They are never separated, even in sleep, whereas the etheric and astral bodies are obliged at that time to part company. Again, there is an intimate connection between the ego and the astral organization, for they too are never separated all through the earthly life. The connection between the astral and the etheric bodies is not so close, and a separation between these can take place. This fact is a very distinct effect upon man's earthly life, as also upon his non-earthly life. In our waking state, when our ego animates the senses, and our astral body, the nervous system, we may wish to send into the etheric and physical bodies the experiences derived from this connection, as indeed we must do while we live in the physical world. Materialism believes that the physical body is all in all to the human being because, as a matter of fact, everything must be impressed into the physical body and revealed therein during man's life, from birth or conception to death. This work of registering the experiences of earth life in the etheric and physical bodies is, however, not accomplished without many difficulties and hindrances. We are not really able, without further ado, to send down into the organs belonging to the body of formative forces and into the physical body what we experience through our senses, or attach to our nervous system through our thinking. That which we absorb from the external physical world is, when we first take it in, so constructed and formed that it resembles external existence. For instance, if we perceive something having an angular shape, this at first creates in our ego and astral bodies the experiences of something angular. The etheric body at first opposes the acceptance of what we experience in the physical outer world. Imaginative cognition can alone throw light upon what then takes place. For neither our ordinary sense observation, nor even physical experiments of the human being himself, nor intellectual reflection can succeed in visualizing this process, which consists in the necessary reconstruction and remodeling of what we observe with our sense perception so that it may be able to live on in our etheric and physical bodies, so that we may be able to part from it in sleep. Only when we are in a position to observe the true relation between waking and sleeping in man do we realize that there is a continual struggle going on in life. We absorb an outer impression. This cannot at once enter the physical and etheric bodies. For, if I may once more make use of what is really a somewhat rough and uncouth example, if we have had the experience of an angular object, that can only pass into the etheric and physical bodies after it has been rounded off and adapted to the form of those bodies. It has to undergo a complete transformation. The transformation of what is at first of as transient and spiritual a nature as the ego and astral bodies themselves into a plastic form which can live on in the etheric body, and into a mobile movement which can live on in the physical body, this transforming process sets up an inner conflict, which is, of course, unknown to the ordinary human consciousness of today. But anyone who possesses imaginative cognition is able to perceive this battle, which generally lasts from 2 to 3 days. We must have slept 2 or 3 times upon an experience before it unites itself with the former ones already imprinted into the physical and etheric bodies. The dream world is an external expression of this conflict, but only an external expression. When a man dreams, his ego and astral bodies slip into his etheric and physical bodies, as I have already explained, and get blocked up there. This blocking, this damming up, is the expression of the conflict just described, which lasts for 2 or 3 days. When a man has only slept once upon his experience, it does not yet sink deeply enough into his etheric body. That only takes place when he has slept 2 or 3 times on it. Therefore, just where the astral and etheric bodies of a man are somewhat loosely joined, we see a continual interweaving. This can be roughly sketched as follows, and there's no picture here, but maybe there is in some other book or in the back. If this be the etheric body, and he has it painted in pink, and the astral body during sleep, he has it in yellow, we find at the time of waking or falling asleep a continual conflict going on at the junction, an active, lively struggle, which is expressed externally in dreams, but which inwardly represents this interweaving of the experiences of the etheric and physical bodies. Only when a man has slept 2 or 3 times, and sometimes oftener, upon some experience, does it take its place with what is already connected with the etheric and physical body as memory. The whole purpose is that the experience should be transformed into memory, and thus remain lying in the bed while we sleep. For memory is really the expression of the thoughts of the physical and etheric bodies. Thus, only after 2 or 3 days are our experiences interwoven into our memory. It is an extremely interesting experience for the imaginative cognition to perceive this. Even the form in which it is expressed is of significance. We approach the external experiences of our earth life in such a way that we give them certain contours in accordance with natural law. We experience what is to be found in our earth existence in definite forms, one might say in the forms produced by the laws of nature. Now, as soon as these experiences are interwoven into the etheric body, the laws of nature cease to hold sway. Everything which here possesses sharp outlines becomes soft and plastic. All that is still becomes mobile, and all that is angular assumes curved lines. All our intellectual experiences, all that we as intellectual men experience, is changed into what we experience with our artistic faculties. That is the inner reason why, in those olden times, when men could still perceive instinctively what I have just described, art occupied a very different position from what it does today. Even as recently as the Renaissance, Raphael and other artists of that time, in groping back for the old art, still possessed at least traditions of this transmutation of the intellectual into the artistic. For as soon as we ascend to the supersensible, what is intellectual loses its intellectual form and becomes artistic. The fact that art now tends so strongly to naturalism, and that people wish to copy the exact model, shows how very far they have departed from the real nature of art. Mankind must find its way back to this true world of art. Man can therefore sum up his life in the manner described. I have an experience. For 3 days it percolates into my etheric body. What I experience the next day pours in a day later. We may therefore say, man has not completed an experience as far as the etheric body is concerned until 3 or 4 days after its occurrence. Now, when a man passes through the portal of death, the etheric body separates from the physical body, a happening which never took place during earth life. All that has been woven into the etheric body during the 3 day periods is now released from the etheric body, which is detaching itself from the physical body. The time occupied in this process of dissolution is about as long as was the interweaving process. This proves to the imagination, if it has acquired the right judgment, that it is the physical body, through its resistance, which holds together all that gradually wandered over into the etheric body. For during the first few days after the death of the physical body, it can be seen how all that was woven into the etheric body is released again into the universal cosmic ether. For 2, 3, or 4 days after his death, man experiences this dissolution of all his treasured memories. This may be called the putting off of the etheric body, but it is in reality an enlargement of the memories. They grow greater, they lose the third dimension and become the two-dimensional and pictorial in character. After passing through the portal of death, a man is confronted with the whole collective tableau of his life, which passes before him in living pictures, and this lasts for 2, 3, or 4 days, differing in individual cases. Just as a man who studies botany can tell by examining a seed what kind of a plant it will produce, so one who has attained imaginative cognition not only sees at death the passing of the etheric body, that is to say, of the whole memory system into the cosmos, but he can also see it in its earlier pictorial form, for in pictures it is always present in man. If one knows how to understand aright what is continually being transformed for 3 days, or perhaps longer, one can see in the embodying of the experiences in the etheric body a symbolic preparation for what man must inevitably experience inwardly for 2, 3, or 4 days after passing through the portal of death. Whereas a man in earth life, unless he has attained to imaginative cognition, experiences more or less unconsciously this process of involving his experiences into his memory, which is kept together by the physical body, directly after his death, he experiences the evolving, the unwinding, and the passing out of his memories into the cosmos. Thus, what we leave behind us as our memory treasure every time we go to sleep passes out immediately after our death into the universe and becomes one with the cosmos. That is what we must give over to cosmic existence at our death. We must not only grasp these things by means of our reason, we must also absorb them into our feeling. Such a process as the one just described must make us feel that a man must not take an egoistic view of his existence. He must realize that while he stands in the world as a thinking being, his thoughts do not belong to himself alone. For after his death they must pass out into the whole cosmos and become forces which continue to work therein. If we think good thoughts, we give over our good thoughts to the cosmos at our death. If we think evil thoughts, we give over our evil thoughts to the cosmos at our death. For man is not only put into earth existence to develop simply as a free being. That he certainly must do, and we shall have more to say on that subject in the subsequent lectures. But there is yet another reason why he must become a free and independent being. He is put into the world that he may become a being through whom the gods themselves work to guide the cosmos from epoch to epoch. I might say that what the gods have to weave as thought into the cosmos, they must prepare in what can be thought and pondered over in the lives of individual human beings. These lives are the sanctuaries in which the gods must cultivate those thoughts which they continually require in the development of the world, so that they may embody them in their cosmos as actual impulses of force. Man, in his life between sleeping and waking, is, with his ego and astral organization, outside his physical and etheric bodies. In this condition, he, as spiritual being, as ego and astral body, is interwoven in the spiritual forces which penetrate the whole cosmos. He is in that world, which, if I may express myself symbolically, is outside his skin. He is in that of which, from the time he awakes until he falls asleep, he receives only sense impressions. In sleep, he enters the inner part of the things, which during his waking life reveal only their external side. Nothing but which is experienced by the astral organization while outside the physical and etheric bodies can be carried back into the thoughts of the etheric body, for what the ego experiences outside cannot be carried back. Hence, in all that the ego actually experiences during the whole of earth life, that part which takes place during sleep must, for the ordinary consciousness, and indeed even for the imaginative consciousness, remain beneath the surface. It is only accessible to inspirational consciousness in the manner described in these lectures. We may therefore say that, as regards these experiences, which can be impressed into man's thoughts, he possesses the power, the force, which he acquires during sleep, to carry them down and impress them in his etheric body. During his earth life, however, he has not sufficient force to enable him to carry down the experiences undergone by the ego during the immediate period between sleeping and waking, at which are the consequence of the wishes and desires connected with the earthly experiences passed through during the waking interval. In fact, in our epoch, none but the part which can be transmuted or impressed into his thoughts, during his sleep life, passes into the conscious waking life of earthly man. On the other hand, all that man's real ego experiences during sleep remains, I might say, concealed behind the veil of existence. To the imaginative and inspirational consciousness, things come to light here which can perfectly well be understood by the normal, healthy human reason, but which in our present civilization are regarded with a very great deal of prejudice. Indeed, it requires a certain freedom from prejudice to grasp the fact that everything in the physical world is three-dimensional and is fundamentally experienced in three dimensions, and that whatever is to be impressed in the etheric body must pass from the plastic into the pictorial form, from the three-dimensional into the two-dimensional. For as soon as we enter the imaginative world, we have nothing more to do with three dimensions, and still less with four dimensions, as is believed today by certain scientists who have deviated from the main track. We are there concerned with two dimensions only. The reason why it is so difficult to conceive of what is thus experienced lies in the fact that in our earthly experiences we are accustomed to deal only with three dimensions. We picture everything in three dimensions, and therefore when we are required to find a transition into two dimensions, we say, well, but the two dimensions are included in the three. The two dimensions of a surface may be such that the third dimension is also there. This cannot be the case when we enter the imaginative world. For no matter what a surface may be, there can be no third dimension there. It is no longer taken into account the moment we enter the etheric imaginative world. Hence mathematicians must transform all the equations of ether so that they do not refer to the three-dimensional, but to the two-dimensional world. This is merely interpolated for mathematicians. Now, if we wish to enter the world accessible to inspiration, that world in which we live as egos between going to sleep and waking, we find it to be a one-dimensional world. We are concerned with a world of one dimension only. The transition into that world of a single dimension, which presupposes that the student shall have acquired the quality of inspiration, of perceiving the spiritual world in which we live between going to sleep and waking, the understanding of that world was in all ages possessed by the so-called science of initiation. I described in yesterday's lecture how in men of the type of Jacob Böhme the concealed sun forces were manifest, not the force of the external physical sunlight, but the concealed sun forces. And these are of such a nature that they do not extend in three dimensions, but can only be perceived in one dimension. An older, more instinctive initiation knowledge was able to reach this inspiration, although it had no clear self-conscious knowledge of it. But it did penetrate thus far. Much of what is preserved to us in the ancient documents of older epochs of humanity can only be understood when we know that it refers to the spiritual, one-dimensional world which can be attained by inspiration. And as regards our earth life, it refers to the concealed solar and stellar forces. In the interval between falling asleep and waking, we do not live in manifested sun forces, but in the concealed ones. These latter penetrate certain stones, for instance, although the physical manifested sun forces do not. But when they penetrate these stones, they become one-dimensional. The man who attains inspirational vision does not see the physical light in the usually non-transparent stone. What he sees are the concealed sun forces, so that the stones become pervious to the concealed sun forces, and also to the forces of inspiration. In olden times, in the very ancient times of man's development on earth, such expedients were not necessary. But when the old instinctive clairvoyance, which laid the foundation of the old initiation knowledge, was on the decline, such expedients were resorted to, shortcuts I might call them, to enable men to perceive what could no longer be seen by instinctive, inspired cognition. For example, one method was as follows. A number of stones were collected. If they are so arranged that on certain occasions the rays of the sun fall upon the covering stone, the physical sun rays are arrested, and the concealed sun rays pass through. When a man who had trained himself for the purpose placed the stones in order and looked through them from the side, he saw the spiritual, one-dimensional sun rays passing through them and vanishing into the earth. If a man made use of such an expedient, in those days of direct perception, through the instinctive forces of clairvoyance, and set up the stones in this way, he could, looking from the side at the space covered by the small shadow throne, see the world of the spiritual sun rays, in which man lives every night, and even during his afternoon naps. He saw into this world, which man experiences during every period of sleep. Thus, in just such contrivances as are to be found in this very neighborhood, we can see the means by which, during a time of transition, which, however, was of long duration, a particular order of wise leaders of humanity tried to penetrate to the concealed sun forces, to which a man such as Jacob Boehme penetrated simply by contemplation of earthly things. Even today, when we see such an arrangement of stones in suitable places, their real meaning can only be experienced through what spiritual science can teach us. Otherwise, we shall go away, even from such things as these, with an external and altogether inapposite explanation of them. Inapposite is INAPPOSITE. Such stones can also be placed in a circle, showing the particular differentiations of the spiritual sun rays according to the different constellations. For this, a circle is, of course, necessary. I have now endeavored to make comprehensible to you the world in which our ego lives between going to sleep and waking. This world is not kept together by what lies in the physical and etheric bodies. Yet from these bodies, which alone bring about clear consciousness in earthly man, come the opinions that we form about our own actions, our own inner experiences, and our thoughts. And these opinions are again modified by our feelings and also by our will. Hence, in our waking state, we judge of our external life as best we can according to the thoughts we have been able to impress in our physical and etheric bodies. But not only have we ourselves something to say concerning what we experience and what we do, but the whole cosmos has something to say too. It judges. It decides whether an action, a thought, or a feeling is good or evil. The opinions we ourselves form between waking and going to sleep concerning what we as human beings are but our own formation. What the cosmos, the spiritual substance of the cosmos, which, as I have sufficiently explained in the course of these lectures, contains the moral element within it in place of the laws of nature. What the cosmos has to say concerning our human nature and our human actions that is experienced by the ego during the period between sleeping and waking. Inspiration reveals the fact that even in the briefest period of sleep, the ego experiences all that we have gone through from the time we last woke until this present sleep, whether it be short or long. If, therefore, these are the successive conditions, waking, sleeping, waking, sleeping, a man experiences over again in his sleep all that he lived through in his last waking time, and more especially in so far as it concerns himself. This experience, in so far as it is the experience of the ego, remains unknown to the ordinary earthly consciousness, but inspiration can call it to mind when the peculiar nature of the experience discloses itself, and we can see what it is. In this experience, we live through things in the reverse direction from that in which we passed through them during the day. Thus, suppose you recapitulate your experience from morning to evening. I now exclude the shorter periods of sleep. In your sleeping state, you pass retrospectively through all your experiences from the evening back to the morning, traveling backward through them. This is done in such a way that you experience what the cosmos, the spiritual cosmos, has to say concerning the doings of your day. During the earthly life of present-day man, he cannot, however, be conscious of this. But it will have to penetrate his consciousness. Otherwise man, as an existing being, would have to fall out of cosmic existence. Inspirational cognition shows us that after the 2, 3, or 4 days, during which man, after his death, surveys the tableau of his life, when his memories evolve out into the cosmos, after this experience, which is often called the releasing of the etheric body, a time begins in which he can look back on his earthly life in another way. When we survey these few days, immediately after death, a mighty tableau is indeed unfolded. But within it, at first, can be seen only what we experience during our waking periods. Yet, in reality, man has not only lived through what happened in his waking periods, but also what he experienced in his periods of sleep. When you look back in your ordinary earthly life, by means of your memories, you always omit the periods of sleep. You look back, for instance, on the 25th of August, 1923, as though you had experienced that day only, and not the previous night. You do not include the experiences of that night. They are withheld from your consciousness. You only recollect the experiences of the 24th, the 23rd of August, and so on, back to the time of your birth, which you do not remember. All this, as a matter of fact, is what also appears during the 2 or 3 days after death. After that begins the period when the soul and spirit nature, having become strong enough after death to do so, experiences in the spiritual world what it could only unconsciously form in pictures during each interval between going to sleep and waking. This now appears as past experiences, which a man lives through retrospectively for a period as long as the third of his life, which in an ordinary earth life is the length of time he spends in sleep. After his death, man lives through a period lasting as long as the third of his earthly life, during which he again passes retrospectively through his earthly life, beginning with his last night, then the preceding one, and so on, back to his birth, or even conception. In my book, Theosophy, I have described this retrospective journey of man through quite a different world after his death, from a different point of view, as the passage of the human soul and spirit being through the soul world. If a man dies at 21, he spends about 7 years in the soul world. If he dies at 60, he remains there for about 20 years, just as long as the time spent in sleep during his life here on earth. After he has concluded his passage through that world, he is then faced with the necessity of experiencing that which he, with his whole being, has made of the earth existence which the gods created, that they might, with the help of the human race, bring the world a little further forward. Until the end of this retrospective experience of his nights, man, after his death, experiences what he has made of himself and what he signifies to the cosmos. He must then learn what the earth itself has become through him. This takes a long time. We shall go into this more fully in the next lecture. It occupies half the time between the earthly death and a new earth life. When we go back retrospectively through our nights, we first of all come to our birth, after which, having traversed the soul world till we come to that occurrence, going back from our death, we must then travel back to our preceding earth life. Thus a man can take his preceding earth life with him as a help toward forming another, a third earth life. Not only must he go back to his birth, in his life after death, he must also travel back to his former earth life. This leads us into one of the realms of the old initiation science, which must now be renewed in a way adapted to the present capacities of mankind. That science of initiation, which in all times carried knowledge into man's religious experience. For initiation science is always true knowledge, knowledge which leads from the world of sense into the spiritual world, so that it may so stimulate man's will that it takes a religious form. To the initiation science of all ages, it was always a very important experience, as revealed by intuitive cognition, the third kind of cognition described here. It was of quite special importance to man when, after having traveled back through life as far as his preceding earth life, he encountered on the way a being who could be his guide after death. In one particular region of the earth, men said, "I must, during my earth life, absorb the teachings of the last bodhisattva who appeared on the earth." A man may have lived, let us say, some 300 years after the appearance of the bodhisattva. But after his death, when he travels back through a longer period of time to his preceding earth life, he reaches the time when the last bodhisattva lived on earth. The old initiation wisdom attributed to this meeting with the last bodhisattva the fact that man could really find a link with his preceding earth life. That is to say, that he could thus find the strength for everlasting life, which can only be found when he has established a connection with his last earth life. The possibility of thus encountering the bodhisattva, who descended into the earthly sphere from certain regions of the spiritual, ceased at a definite epoch of man's evolution and of the evolution of the world. Today, the position is such that if a man were able, after his death, to make the retrospective journey to his birth or conception, and then try to go back still further to his preceding earth life, he would not be able to establish a connection with it. This connection could be established during the first millennia of the earth's evolution before the mystery of Golgotha. For in that retrospective journey, man wandered back to the time of the last bodhisattva. This retrospective journey is of no use to man today, unless it be undertaken under the guidance of that being who united himself with the earth through the mystery of Golgotha. In other words, this signifies that it will be no good to man unless he has established such relation to the mystery of Golgotha that Christ can be his guide. For Christ comprises in himself all the powers of guidance that formerly were to be found during life between death and a new birth by reason of the appearance on earth of the bodhisattvas. Thus the event of the mystery of Golgotha is one of the most important facts for man's experiences between death and rebirth in the whole evolution of the earth. If therefore we wish to learn to know the spiritual evolution of the earth and the place it occupies in the spiritual evolution of the cosmos, and if we also wish to understand what man goes through in his spiritual life after death in connection with this, it is necessary to place the mystery of Golgotha in the whole world development. For the man of the present day, a bridge must therefore be found, leading from the observation of the evolution of man to the observation of the evolution of the world. And this must be done by considering the mystery of Golgotha in its whole fundamental significance in the earthly sphere for the occurrences of the evolution of the earth and of man. We shall deal with these things, in so far as they can now be revealed by the modern science of initiation, and which play their part in connection with what man experiences after death, after the retrospection of his night experiences, in the next lecture, in connection with the evolution of the world. The end of Lecture 8.